Welcome to the African American Hour. I'm Byron Buckner with 60 minutes of news, information, and commentary. This week, I have two readings from the Baltimore Afro-American about sickle cell anemia, a look at philanthropy at HBCUs from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution newspaper, an obituary from the New York Times. I'm going to wrap up the program with an Atlanta Journal-Constitution report on women's health, and I'm starting with this story about the economics of HBCU sports. The title is, All Money Ain't Good Money. Have Money Games Outgrown Value in HBCU Football? This was written by Terrence Harris and published September 18, 2025 in the Houston Defender and its defendernetwork.com website. This is the black newspaper out of Houston, Texas. Grambling State coach Mickey Joseph reignited a controversial conversation recently after his Tigers suffered a 70-0 loss at number one ranked Ohio State University in an early season college football game. For their efforts, Grambling State University received a record $1 million payday in what are known as money games. The concept of money games in HBCU football, where FCS programs receive large payouts in exchange for hitting the road and suffering a humiliating defeat to teams at the top level of college football who are better stocked with superior talent and funding, is not new. But this divide has grown so much wider in this era of the transfer portal. Name, image, and likeness, NIL money, and now revenue sharing, which has essentially allowed FBS Power 4 programs to put together teams with values that exceed most HBCUs' total athletic department budgets. While praising his players and assistant coaches for a valiant effort against the Buckeyes, Joseph let it be known that his program had been asked to stand at the bottom of a mountain that was impossible to climb. What do they have? A $35 million roster? I don't have a $35 million roster, Joseph quipped in the post-game press conference. Maybe we could put our money together and we could come up with $35 million, but I doubt it. Joseph's words have restarted a conversation that has gone on for years. Whether these money games are fair to the HBCU student athletes who are outmanned and overmatched in these games, where they are almost always guaranteed to suffer humiliating defeats and sometimes serious injury. Deion Sanders raised the point the loudest a few years ago when he was the head coach at Jackson State, when he said the games are unfair to the student athletes and questioned whether the paydays, usually in the $300,000 range, were enough for the potential risk of injury. HBCU athletic directors and administrators will tell you that these money games are necessary to provide needed dollars not just to the football team and other athletic programs, but also for the bands, which are always a part of these games, and the school's general fund. Joseph questions whether the reward is worth the potential harm these games present to the psyche and health of the student athletes. I guarantee you, I didn't wake up and say, I want to play Ohio State. But we do use it for financial help, said Joseph, whose team played Division II Kentucky State of the SIAC the next game before jumping into SWAC play. We did our part. We helped financially. Now the playing field is even and we did our part. Now it's time to move on. Our players understand that because we don't hide anything from them. Texas Southern and Prairie View also take part in the money games. Prairie View went over to Rice and suffered a 3-touchdown loss earlier this month in a game in which the Panthers actually led 7-0 early in the first quarter before ultimately losing 38-17 for a $350,000 payday. Prairie View athletic director Anton Goff did not respond to interview requests from the Defender for this story. Texas Southern went out to Cal of the ACC, where the Tigers trailed just 11-0 at halftime before eventually suffering a 35-3 loss in exchange for a $625,000 check, which will be shared with football, athletics, and Texas Southern University's world-famous Ocean of Soul marching band for the trip to the Bay Area. Days later, TSU coach Chris Dishman, without prompting, mentioned the $25 million roster the Bears have in comparison to his non-existent roster value. The Tigers' entire athletic department budget is about $15,800,000. But when the defender asked Dishman about his feelings on whether the money game should be played, the second-year coach declined to elaborate. "I can't really answer that question. I haven't been in HBCUs or Texas Southern long enough to answer a question like that," Dishman said to the defender. "But to me, it's whoever is on your schedule, you are supposed to win. You go out there to fight to win the game, and whatever happens, happens. They were on our schedule. We were supposed to win that game. We were in that game to win it. We weren't in that game just to show up for the money. We were in it to win the game." That is likely the case for every HBCU program forced into these money games, but the consequences can be tough. In a recent matchup between North Carolina A&T and the Big 12's University of Central Florida, the Aggies took a 68-7 thumping, but the Aggies' top three quarterbacks were knocked out of the game to add insult to injury. For our team, North Carolina A&T Sean Gibbs responded to a reporter's question about whether the payday was worth it. "I don't think it's worth it. I mean, we got 60-plus points put on us and lost three quarterbacks. Yeah, for me it was a good environment, great platform, but is that worth it? I don't know." Joseph also questions the true value of money games, but he reminded his players that the season isn't about how you start, but how you finish. "Most ultimately, it can hurt the confidence getting slaughtered 70-0, Joseph said. "But immediately after the game, we made sure to reiterate to the players that this has nothing to do with what's going to happen here on out, because nobody remembers what you did in September in November. Now the playing field is even, but it definitely can take people's confidence. We had to make sure that we looked at it with reality when we looked at it as coaches. This is a very confident group. They understand why we had to play the game, but just like me, they wanted to come out healthy, and we have." That was the article, "All Money Ain't Good Money. Have Money Games Outgrown Value in HBCU Football?" This was written by Terrence Harris and published September 18, 2025, in the Houston Defender newspaper's DefenderNetwork.com website. Next, another reading about the cost of operating historically black colleges and universities, titled "$55 Million Gift Still Boosts Atlanta Historically Black Colleges and Universities." This was written by Mirtha Dornestorg and published September 14, 2025, in the Sunday edition of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution newspaper. 5 years ago, the fortunes and futures of three of Atlanta's historically black colleges and universities changed unexpectedly. In the years since, Clark Atlanta University and Morehouse and Spelman Colleges have funded changes to their schools that will ripple for generations to come. Before the summer of 2020, Mackenzie Scott was largely unknown. If people had heard of her, it was likely as an author or the ex-wife of Amazon founder Jeff Bezos. She had briefly been in the tabloids when she and Bezos announced in 2019 that they were divorcing after 25 years of marriage. In the split, Scott received a portion of their Amazon stock worth more than $38 billion at the time. That same year, Scott promised to give away the majority of her wealth either during her lifetime or in her will, writing at the time she would keep at it until the safe is empty. But after July 2020, Scott's profile skyrocketed. She began following through on her pledge, donating billions to institutions amid the summer of racial reckoning after the murder of George Floyd, with all her gifts being unrestricted and often unsolicited. Morehouse, Spelman, and Clark Atlanta University have been three of the beneficiaries of her largesse, which up until that point hadn't previously received such major donations from businesses and philanthropists. In July 2020, she gave Morehouse and Spelman $20 million each. Then in December 2020, she gave Clark Atlanta University $15 million. The money had no strings attached, meaning over the past 5 years, the schools have been able to do a variety of things such as fund scholarships, boost their endowments, and seed the construction of new buildings. It was refreshing to see a donor who really, genuinely wants to help organizations without having any restrictions, said Hodan Hassan. Morehouse's vice president of the Office of Institutional Advancement and chief advancement officer. What that really conveys is trusting those organizations to utilize the resources as they need and as they see fit. Morehouse allocated the $20 million it received to a new three-story, 580,000-square-foot campus center. It will soon build for students. The school's vision is for the center to be a hub for innovation, collaboration, and community among students, faculty, alumni, and business leaders. Morehouse estimates it will cost $80 million to build. Including Scott's gift, the school has raised $45 million so far, according to Hassan. For Clark Atlanta University, Scott's $15 million donation is still the single largest private individual gift in the university's history. Ms. Scott's generous gift has been a true turning point for Clark Atlanta University. It has helped us fortify our financial base, enrich our academic offerings, expand opportunities for our scholars, and significantly enhance our visibility and reputation, George T. French Jr., the school's president, said in an email. Clark Atlanta University allocated the majority of the funding, $10 million, to its endowment, French said. Endowments are pivotal in an institution's long-term future and can be turned to in economic downturns. Clark Atlanta University allocated $3 million of her gift to revitalize its W.E.B. Du Bois Southern Center for Studies of Public Policy, which does research on environmental justice, social justice, race, and civil rights issues. It also houses the school's new labor institute. Lastly, the university put $1.5 million into its Center for Innovation and Entrepreneurial Development and $500,000 toward full tuition scholarships for Atlanta Public Schools students. Spelman put $11 million of Scott's $20 million gift into its endowment, the school said in a statement. The college also allocated some funding to scholarships. In 2020, every student received a $3,500 award, and another $1.1 million was used as a match to Spelman's Social Justice Scholars Program. The rest of the money went toward enhancing the student experience and institutional priorities, like technology upgrades and academic programming, Spelman said. All three schools said that Scott has never given them direct feedback about how her gifts were used, but said her gifts have had impacts beyond just the money. One of the most significant indirect effects of Ms. Scott's gift has been its catalytic impact on our fundraising efforts, French said. Her donation helped launch the school's $250 million capital campaign, and after she donated to the school, Clark Atlanta University received $5.5 million in gifts from other philanthropists and a $10 million award from the National Science Foundation, according to French. For Morehouse, Scott's donation, coupled with other gifts the school received around the same time, really built the confidence for other philanthropists that Morehouse is worth the investment, Hassan said. In 5 years, Scott has given away more than $19.2 billion to more than 2,450 nonprofits, with at least $256 million donated to Georgia-based organizations, according to Yield Giving, a database of her donations. But that's still a fraction of Scott's wealth. Her net worth is still more than $34 billion, according to Forbes. Yield, Scott's group, does not have contact information for Scott, and the Atlanta Journal-Constitution was unable to reach her for this story. That was the article titled, $55 million gift still boosts Atlanta HBCUs. This was written by Mirtha Dornestorg and published September 14, 2025, in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution newspaper. Next, I have the first of two stories about sickle cell anemia, a disease that affects many African Americans. The title of this story is, Black Blood Donors Play a Critical Role in Saving Lives, but Representation Still Lags. This was written by Tashi McQueen and published September 14, 2025, in the Baltimore Afro-American Newspaper's Afro.com website. Black donors are crucial for the U.S. blood supply, but representation still lags. This gap means sickle cell patients are not getting blood that matches them the best. If you have more diversity in the blood donor supply, the higher the chance that you will find blood that's a match for sickle cell patients, said Dr. Christina Bariteau, physician and medical director of the blood bank at Lurie Children's Hospital of Chicago. The diversity of the blood donation supply is definitely not matching the increasing diversity of our nation. According to Scott Marder, M-A-R-D-E-R, regional communications manager for the National Capital and Greater Chesapeake Region of American Red Cross, Black people have unique structures in their red blood cells that make it difficult to find a compatible unit of blood in other donor populations. Sickle cell impacts 100,000 people in the United States. About 90% of them are Black. While the American Red Cross reports progress in recruiting more Black and other minority group donors, the number is still far short of reflecting the nation's diversity. Working with community partners, we've rebuilt and strengthened our Black and African American donor base by a 74% increase from the lowest point during the pandemic, surpassing pre-COVID-19 levels, said Marder. Prior to the pandemic, blood donors who are Black represented just about 4% of all Red Cross blood donors, which made it challenging to collect enough life-saving blood donations to meet the needs of sickle cell patients and others in need, he added. Bariteau said many are eligible to donate blood, but recognize the historical mistrust of the medical system that can make increasing turnout difficult. To improve this situation, Bariteau called for greater awareness of the need for blood donation, coordinated communication campaigns, and stronger partnerships with communities. She said organizations should not just go into a community and ask for blood. It needs to be a sustainable commitment carried out alongside them. She noted that more diversity among doctors increases the likelihood of finding a match for sickle cell patients. The more diversity of the blood donor supply, the higher the chance that you will find blood that's a match for sickle cell patients, she said. Black individuals tend to be a better match for patients with sickle cell disease. Both Bariteau and Marder said that donating blood is a safe process and people should not hesitate to give or receive blood. Our donor health history screening helps to protect the blood supply, he said. The screening checks on a donor's temperature, blood pressure, and hemoglobin levels, and asks a series of questions designed to ensure that a donor is healthy enough to donate and that their blood is as safe as possible for patients. Marder said blood is only collected from donors who are healthy and feeling well at the time of donation. Bariteau noted that individuals with anemia, bleeding disorders, blood disorders, or cancer are not eligible. Marder and Bariteau offered insight into what it takes to be a regular donor and what the donation experience involves. The entire donation process takes about an hour, and the actual donation lasts about 8 to 10 minutes, Marder said. He said in most states, individuals who are 17 years of age, weigh at least 110 pounds, and are in generally good health, may be eligible to donate blood. Blood can be safely donated every 56 days up to 6 times a year. The donation of power reds, 2 units of blood during one visit, can be donated every 112 days. Platelets can be given every 7 days up to 24 times a year. Every day, volunteer blood and platelet donors across the country are needed to help save lives, said Marder. even when hospitals are fully stocked with blood products. Unexpected events can cause a sudden drop in the availability of life-saving transfusions. We need donors of all ethnicities and blood types to ensure the right blood product is available at the right time. Those interested in donating can go to redcrossblood.org or call 1-800-RED-CROSS. That's 1-800-733-2767. That was the story. Black blood donors play a critical role in saving lives, but representation still lags. This was written by Tashi McQueen and published September 14, 2025, in the Baltimore Afro-American newspaper's Afro.com website. My next reading is titled, Unlocking Sickle Cell Mysteries. Dr. Ambrose Wancom speaks on genetic modifiers and patient outcomes. This was written by Megan Sales and published September 17, 2025 at the website of the Baltimore Afro-American newspaper, Afro.com. When Dr. Ambrose Wancom walked into a panel on medical genetics out of curiosity, he had no idea it would shape the course of his career. Born in Cameroon, Wancom, capital W-O-A-N-K-A-M, has dedicated his career to studying genetic and genomic variations in African populations and their impact on conditions like sickle cell disease. Today, he is the director of the McCusick-Nathans Institute and Department of Genetic Medicine at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. His father's advice had been one of the guiding principles behind his work. He always said, you have to have three major objectives in your life. One is being useful to yourself. The second is being useful to your family. And the third is being useful to your nation, said Wancom. My nation is the African nation, and I did not remember seeing a single African at the time who was a geneticist. I thought if I did genetic medicine, I would certainly be useful to my nation. This week, the Afro connected with Wancom to discuss the role of genetic modifiers in sickle cell disease and their impact on patient care. Baltimore Afro-American, can you explain in simple terms what genetic modifiers of sickle cell are? Dr. Wancom, sickle cell disease is a genetic condition that affects red blood cells. It is caused by a mutation in the gene that makes up the hemoglobin, which is the protein in red blood cells that transports oxygen in our body. It is a condition that evolved in Africa as a variant to confer resistance to malaria if you only have one copy of the mutation. If you inherit two copies of the mutation from your mother and father, you develop the disease. In Nigeria, it is known that without treatment, 50% of children will die before their fifth birthday. It is also the case in Nigeria that without treatment, some children still live up to 60, which is the life expectancy for sickle cell in America. The question is, how is it that one of two people in the same environment, even if that environment is very harsh in terms of healthcare provisions, will survive well above their 50s without appropriate treatment? That's where genetic modifiers come in. If the environment is that bad and you still survive with a very severe condition, that suggests that in some part of your body, there is some other variant or mutation that improves the severity of the condition in you. Genetic modifiers are important because they allow us to understand why one kid is very sick and the other is not when they have the same mutation. When we understand those modifications, they can be amenable to therapeutic modifications for treating the condition. Baltimore Afro-American, what have you learned about these modifiers through your research? Dr. Wancom, in our research, we have revealed modifiers in many sickle cell disease complications. For example, kidney disease and sickle cell disease are modified by three genes, APOL1, alpha thalassemia, and HMOX1. For APOL1, There were some clinical studies published last year showing that if you modify that gene by inhibiting it using genetic technology or a pill, you reduce the occurrence of kidney dysfunction. Importantly, this was in people without sickle cell, suggesting that knowledge we have from sickle cell can also help the general population. We're also very interested in genetic modifiers of fetal hemoglobin. Fetal hemoglobin is the type of hemoglobin present in babies before they are born. It progressively reduces when we're born and becomes nearly zero in all of us as adults. If you maintain the capacity to produce fetal hemoglobin at 8%, it positively modifies your disease. Earlier this year, we published a study about a fetal hemoglobin modifier that we call FLT1, which we strongly believe can be a target for therapeutics in the near future. Baltimore Afro-American. You've discussed how Africa is underrepresented in genetic research. Why does this matter for sickle cell patients? Dr. Wan Kam. It matters for humanity as a whole. There are three reasons why African genomes, in general, are critical for all of us. The first reason is ancestry. We are all African. The first human being evolved in Africa about 300,000 years ago. Present-day Europeans and Asians moved out of Africa only about 50 to 70,000 years ago. Yet, 98% of the genomic data we currently have comes from people of European ancestry. If we only study those genomes, they only represent a small fraction of humanity variation. The second reason is the geography of Africa. Africa stretches from north to south. If you look at Europe and Asia, they're quite horizontal, extending east and west. Africa crosses many regions from different climates and environments. For example, in Cairo, you have the Mediterranean climate. In Central Africa, you have the rainforest. Different environments have different impacts on your genomes. For example, skin color changes based on sun exposure. The third reason is, if you have different environments, you also have different types of infection. For example, you don't have mosquitoes producing malaria in Europe, but you do have it in African rainforest. As a result, the sickle cell mutation evolved in Africa as a survival mechanism to resist malaria. Baltimore Afro-American. How could more inclusive genetic data change care for sickle cell patients globally? Dr. Wan Kam. This ties into genetic modifiers. In the study we published earlier this year, we found 14 new genes that modify fetal hemoglobin, one of which is the FLT1. The variant we discovered in FLT1 was African-specific, meaning that if we did the same research in 1 million Europeans, we would not have found that variant. You refuse the opportunity of discovering new potential targets for sickle cell disease therapeutics. Additionally, studying African populations does not only improve the care for a condition like sickle cell in Africans, it also helps us to understand the human genome, improving care for all of us and for many other conditions. That was the article titled, Unlocking Sickle Cell Mysteries. Dr. Ambrose Wan Kam speaks on genetic modifiers and patient outcomes. This was written by Megan Sales and published September 17, 2025 in the Baltimore Afro-American newspaper and its website, afro.com. Now I'm going to move to an obituary. Al Foster, drummer who put his stamp on jazz music, is dead at 82. This was written by Hank Steamer and published in the New York Times newspaper on Monday, June 2nd, 2025. Al Foster, a drummer who worked with some of the most illustrious names in jazz across a career spanning more than six decades, leaving his distinctive stamp on important recordings by Miles Davis, Sonny Rollins, Joe Henderson, and many others, died on Wednesday, May 28th, at his apartment in Manhattan. He was 82. His daughter, Kiera Foster Bay, announced his death on social media, but did not specify a cause. Mr. Foster came up emulating great bebop percussionists like Max Roach, but his most high-profile early gig came with Mr. Davis, who hired him in 1972 when he was refining an aggressive funk-informed sound. Mr. Foster's springy backbeats firmly anchored the band's sprawling psychedelic jams. In Miles, the biography, written with Quincy Troupe and published in 1989, Mr. Davis praised Mr. Foster's ability to keep the groove going forever. Mr. Foster also excelled in a more conventional jazz mode, lending an alert, conversational swing to bands led by the saxophonist Mr. Henderson and Mr. Rollins, and pianist Herbie Hancock, McCoy Tyner, and Tommy Flanagan. What he was doing was reminiscent of some of the great drummers of our period, Mr. Rollins said of Mr. Foster in a phone interview, citing foundational figures like Art Blakey and Mr. Roach. He always had that feeling about him, those great feelings of those people, and that's why I could never be disappointed playing with Al Foster. He was always playing something which I related to. Mr. Foster often framed his long career as a fulfillment of his early ambitions. I've been so blessed because I've played with everybody I fell in love with when I was a young teenager, he told the website of Jazz Forum, a club in Tarrytown, New York. Mr. Foster also led his own bands and composed a wealth of original music. Every note meant everything to him, and you could feel that in the way he played Adam Birnbaum, a pianist who worked steadily with Mr. Foster in his later years, said in an interview. Aloysius Tyrone Foster was born on January 18, 1943, in Richmond, Virginia. The second of five children born to John and Thelma Giles Foster, he grew up mainly in Harlem, where the family moved when he was 10. His father owned a dry cleaning service and his mother later did domestic work. He gravitated to rhythm early on, partly through an older brother who played congas. My aunt said when I was 3, I was banging on pots and pans, Mr. Foster said in a 2022 Downbeat interview. His father bought him a drum set, but he didn't get serious about the instrument until he heard a 1955 recording of Cherokee by the group Mr. Roach led with the trumpeter Clifford Brown. I didn't know you could make music on drums. So after that, when I came home from school, every day I'd set up my drums and put my ear to the speaker to try to figure out what he was doing, he later said. Mr. Foster left high school early to help care for Miss Foster Bay, the first of four daughters born to him and his first wife, Tina Hunt. He made his recording debut in 1964 on The Thing to Do, an album by the trumpeter Blue Mitchell. Though only 21, he was already showing a firm grasp of the era's broad rhythmic palette, including shimmying calypso beats and deep swing. Mr. Davis recruited Mr. Foster after hearing him play at the Cellar, a club on the Upper West Side of Manhattan. He knocked me out because he had such a groove and he would just lay it right in there, Mr. Davis wrote in his autobiography. As heard on live albums like In Concert, Dark Magus, and Agartha, Mr. Foster, informed by records by Jimi Hendrix, Sly Stone, and James Brown that his employer recommended, brought an indefatigable locomotive power to Mr. Davis's groups. Though he excelled at the pop-conscious style Mr. Davis favored in that era, the aesthetic wasn't always to his liking. I never cared for what I did with him in the 1970s, he told All About Jazz in 2009 of his work with Mr. Davis. I was a jazz drummer, and I thought when he asked me to join the band, I thought it was jazz. But who's gonna turn down a job with Miles Davis? Still, his personal relationship with Davis was strong, and it endured through the trumpeter's hiatus in the second half of the 1970s, and his return to music in the 1980s, and continued until his death in 1991. Mr. Foster's first gig with Mr. Rollins at the Village Vanguard in 1969 lasted only 2 nights before the famously exacting band leader let him go. but Mr. Rollins called him again in 1978 and invited Mr. Foster to perform with him in Europe, and they worked together on and off through the mid-1990s. Al had a lot of what it took to really swing a band, Mr. Rollins said. He noted that Harlem Boys, the funky opening track on his 1979 album, Don't Ask, was named in honor of their shared Harlem heritage. Mr. Foster also recorded often with Mr. Tyner, toured with Mr. Hancock, and performed with Mr. Henderson in a celebrated trio that also included Ron Carter on bass. The group's signature release, The State of the Tenor, recorded live in 1985, came to be regarded as a jazz classic. In the 2000s, Mr. Foster formed the collaborative group Scolo Hofo, with the saxophonist Joe Lovano, the guitarist John Schofield, and the bassist Dave Holland. He also stepped up his band leading efforts, showcasing his writing on albums like Inspirations and Dedications, published in 2019, which included pieces inspired by various family members. He would hear a melody in his head and he would go to the piano very slowly and sort of work it out one note at a time, Mr. Birnbaum said, describing the way Mr. Foster, who did not have conventional musical training, composed. Mr. Foster's marriage to Miss Hunt ended in divorce. In addition to Miss Foster Bay, he is survived by Bonnie Rose Steinberg, his partner of more than 45 years. Three other daughters, Simone Foster, Michelle Morris, and Monique Magistro. Five grandchildren and three great-grandchildren. Brandon Dane Foster, his son with Miss Steinberg, died in 2017. Mr. Foster framed his musical life as a perpetual search for individuality and surprise, as he told the journalist Ted Pantkin for the liner notes to his most recent album, Reflections, released in 2022. When I was coming up, I tried to play like Art Taylor and my solos were like Max Roach. When I heard Tony Williams and then a little later Joe Chambers and Jack DeJohnette, I said to myself, what about me? How come I don't hear my own stuff? It took me years to find something that nobody else played. That quest continued up until his last years. I hate it if I keep playing what I know, Mr. Foster said in 2022, describing his daily practice routine. Show me something I don't know. I want something different. That was the obituary titled, Al Foster, drummer who put his stamp on jazz music, is dead at 82. This was published in the New York Times newspaper on June 2, 2025, and was written by Hank Steamer. My next reading is about women's health care and will take up the remainder of the program. It's titled, Breaking the South's Bias on Uterus Removal, Especially for Black Women. This appeared in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution on September 14, 2025, and was written by Chaya Tong and Justin Price. Tanika Gray Valbrun walked out of the doctor's office, the grief slowly starting to suffocate her. This couldn't be happening. By the time she reached the parking lot, she was bawling, the doctor's words repeating over and over in her mind. She would never have children. She needed to get her uterus completely removed, a hysterectomy. The doctor's final words hung in the air. Forget about it. Just get a surrogate. She made her way to the parking lot, where she collapsed onto the ground as her husband, James, quickly propped her up. I was just so devastated, she remembered. They were newly married, and Valbrun had always wanted to be a mother. She saw a doctor for what she thought was a routine checkup. She knew she had fibroids, growths in her uterus that had caused heavy menstrual bleeding, but didn't think they could keep her from getting pregnant. Valbrun sought a second opinion at another hospital, where she got what sounded to her like miraculous news. She was eligible for a myomectomy, a surgery that would remove her fibroids but save her uterus and her ability to have children. While declining in recent years because of new technologies, hysterectomy is still one of the most commonly performed surgical procedures for women. Nearly 500,000 hysterectomies are performed each year. Black women in the South face the highest hysterectomy rates in the country, according to research by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. And an analysis of federal data by the Atlanta Journal-Constitution shows women in the broader South, defined by the U.S. Census Bureau as the area from Maryland to Texas, are more likely to have had hysterectomies than women in the North and the rest of the country. Like Valbrun, black women are more likely to suffer from fibroids, which often run across generations in the same family. Fibroids are the leading reason for uterus removal among all women. But that doesn't completely account for the disparity in hysterectomy rates between black and white women, said Whitney Robinson, a Duke University School of Medicine associate professor and researcher. The fertility of black women has been devalued traditionally, Robinson said. North Carolina, where she is based, has a troubling history of state-sanctioned forced sterilization for undesirable black people between 1958 and 1968, a study's findings suggest. Women without access to birth control were among those referred for sterilization. In Mississippi, forced sterilization was so common, it was referred to as the Mississippi appendectomy. A lifetime of racial and sociological disparities drives higher hysterectomy rates for black women, Robinson said, pointing to limited access to cutting-edge health care and family history. The racial gap is just one of those really persistent things, and it's more than just higher rates of fibroids, said Robinson, who wrote a 2017 study showing that black women in North Carolina lagged white women in getting outpatient, minimally invasive hysterectomies. Women who grow up in families where hysterectomies are common are more likely to have hysterectomies because that is more normalized for your family, said Dr. Kimmy Dahl, a gynecologic oncologist and professor at the University of Washington School of Medicine's Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology. In many cases, Dahl added, these women with a familial history of hysterectomy may not know when to expect to reach menopause. Faced with severe menstrual pain and uncertainty about when it will all end, that unknown alone can tip the scales towards surgery. Valbrun was taught to respect doctors. She still dresses up for appointments. You're dressing up because you're meeting a professional, family members told her. You take what they say, you know it's like Bible. Yet when the doctor told her she would never have children, something in Valbrun snapped. I knew what I wanted my outcome to be, she said. So there was no way that I could rest knowing that I didn't fight to be a mother. She was all too familiar with fibroids and hysterectomy. Both her mother and grandmother had fibroids, and each one subsequently got a hysterectomy. Her mother lost two sets of twins to fibroids, one before Valbrun was born and one after. Among her friends and family, Valbrun said it's simply called the surgery, reflecting the commonality of the procedure. Knowing her mother's experience with fibroids has helped her feel less alone, she said. But Valbrun had different options than her mother and grandmother did. During 3 myomectomies over the span of 10 years, Valbrun had 27 fibroids surgically removed. It was a terrible recovery. When it was over, she was left with two things, her uterus and an idea. As a CNN content producer and an adjunct professor in the health science department at Spelman College, Valbrun readily knew how to advance her plan to start the White Dress Project, a nonprofit focused on advocacy for fibroids and women's reproductive health awareness globally. She named the nonprofit to reflect a reality that many women with fibroids face, heavy menstrual bleeding and the quiet fear of wearing white. The people who have heavy bleeding, my organization resonates with them because, you know, you understand the concept of never feeling comfortable wearing white, Valbrun said. What we're trying to build at the White Dress Project is this community of self-advocacy. The idea that just because a doctor tells you something doesn't mean that that's your final decision. It's for the women who don't know about fibroids or hysterectomies, don't have access to appropriate health care, and don't have the information needed to push for other options, Valbrun said. She knows she's one of the lucky ones. I get a lot of opportunities to interface with scientists and researchers and professors, etc. But I think we need a lot more people like me who have that opportunity, she said. There's a growing push, both inside and outside the healthcare system, to make a hysterectomy a last resort rather than the first line of treatment. Alternatives include medication, hormonal IUDs, and minimally invasive surgical procedures. One of these alternatives is uterine fibroid embolization, UFE, a non-surgical treatment that starves fibroids of blood so they shrink and die. Dr. John Lipman, a radiologist who runs the Atlanta Fibroid Center, performs UFE by inserting a small sheath into a blood vessel and releasing tiny particles to block the arteries feeding the fibroid. Information is power. How can you make an informed decision if you only know the surgical options, he said. Most women don't want to undergo surgery if they knew of a procedure that didn't require any surgery at all. UFE, he said, takes about 30 minutes with a recovery period of 3 to 4 hours. Despite advancements in technology and alternatives to hysterectomy, there are certain cases when it is the only option. For Kennesaw resident Heather Walker, fibroids got so big they started growing outside of her uterus. She opted for a hysterectomy to get relief. At 45, she didn't expect to have children, and the discomfort of the fibroids in her abdomen was impossible to ignore. When UFE and other non-surgical options failed to shrink Crystal Davis's fibroids, she ended up losing her uterus. She could have had a myomectomy, the surgical removal of fibroids, but she delayed it so long that the fibroids grew to the size of a grapefruit and wrapped around her intestines. A single mom from Ellenwood, Georgia, with a young son, she feared having to take 6 weeks off of work. I was just scared that I wouldn't be able to provide for my family by not working for 6 weeks, she said. I didn't fully understand that I was doing more harm than good. Just before surgery, Davis begged her OBGYN for a partial hysterectomy. While she wasn't planning for more children, she was terrified of losing her organs. In the end, her surgeon left her cervix and ovaries intact. Hysterectomies, when paired with ovarian removal, have been linked to increased rates of heart disease, cognitive impairment, and severe early menopause, recent research shows. The procedure, in essence, triggers menopause regardless of the woman's age. Dr. Sunjata Reddy, an OBGYN at Northside Hospital's Premier Care for Women, said she is conservative about opting for surgery. When she does operate, she wants to know that I've tried everything to avoid being there because surgeries have risks. Studies show that hysterectomies alone, even without ovarian removal, cause increased long-term risk of cardiovascular and metabolic conditions. Women under the age of 35 who underwent a hysterectomy, one study said, had a higher risk of congestive heart failure and coronary artery disease. There has been a shift toward leaving the ovaries intact while performing hysterectomies, said Dr. Kristen Madison, OBGYN and author of the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists Physician's Guidance. Scientific research breaks the country into four regions and shows that hysterectomy rates in the southern region are the highest of the four groups. But the data in that study, based on the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's Behavioral Risk Factor Surveillance System, only goes up to 2020. The Atlanta Journal-Constitution examined the latest available BRFSS hysterectomy data through 2022, which showed a continuing trend from the research. Black women, 25.5%, and women from the South, 24%, continue to report the highest rates of hysterectomy in the United States. The state-by-state breakdown shows that in Georgia, black women said they had a hysterectomy less often than white women did, 21.3% to 28.8%. Dahl and Robinson collaborated on research showing that black women early on get fewer options for alternatives to hysterectomy. They have observed that the threshold for hysterectomy is generally lower in the South, both for providers who regularly perform hysterectomies and for patients for whom the procedure has become normalized. Black women do not receive the same number of treatment alternatives prior to hysterectomy, Dahl said. When women are not offered other options like IUD, hormonal or non-hormonal medication management, or more minor procedures, she added, their situation worsens and they have no other option but a hysterectomy. Like her mother before her, Robinson underwent a hysterectomy in her 40s. She later learned the surgery could have been avoided. A fibroid had degenerated and caused her worsening pain and bleeding, but she was misdiagnosed and didn't get fibroid treatment in time. They would have had to do an MRI, probably, to really see what was happening, she said. If I had seen somebody who was a specialist, who was more dedicated to figuring out my underlying problem, they would have been able to properly diagnose that, and that could have changed it. Dahl has seen the difference between attitudes toward hysterectomy in the North and South firsthand. I trained in New York, Chicago, and North Carolina, and now I'm in Seattle, and hysterectomy is just so much more normalized in the South, Dahl said. Like Robinson, many women in the South do not have access to adequate women's health care from the start, which could prevent a serious surgery like a hysterectomy. Georgia is falling behind for maternal and child health care even when compared to other southern states, said Tamara Mason, director of the Maternal and Child Health Collective Impact at the March of Dimes. The collective works to reduce inequities in preterm births and maternal mortality. In more than 40% of Georgia's 159 counties, women do not have access to an OBGYN at all, according to a 2024 March of Dimes study. The research also showed that access to care is worsening in Georgia and nationwide as the number of maternity care deserts increases, resulting in more areas where there are no hospitals with obstetric care and zero OBGYNs, certified nurse midwives, certified midwives, or family physicians who deliver babies. In healthcare deserts, women may travel hours to reach the nearest provider. Even when OBGYNs are available in rural areas, they may not have access to the tools and technologies to perform procedures that avoid hysterectomies. Rural areas may also have providers who are decades removed from their medical training and not as aware of the latest technologies that allow for alternative treatments, Dahl said. For the patient, traveling for follow-ups every few months may be difficult or impossible, making a one-and-done option like hysterectomy more appealing. Some procedures also require specialists, which could involve even more travel. A lot of times, doctors are being dismissive, and they're only offering hysterectomies because it's just what they know, what they've seen or haven't seen, that guides their perspective on how a patient should be treated, Valbrun said. Gaps in care also stem from state policy. States with limits on Medicaid, like Georgia, see high rates of uninsured populations, usually women in their prime working years when hysterectomies often occur, Robinson said. Women who are in healthcare deserts, uninsured, or both, lack access to quality women's healthcare, which leads to complications down the road and often hysterectomy. In a post-Roe era, states with tight abortion restrictions see even more fallout for women's healthcare access all around with fewer maternity health providers available, a recent study said. Women in states like Georgia are also most at risk for skipping necessary care due to costs without health insurance. Valbrun's personal journey reinforced her commitment to the White Dress Project and helping other women experience what she's been able to, the joy of living fibroid-free while not sacrificing the ability to give birth. The White Dress Project celebrated its 11th year anniversary in July with a Night in White Gala in New York City and an Empowered Patient Summit in partnership with New York University Langone Health Center for Fibroid Care. The gala, the nonprofit's prime fundraiser, honors people who are doing the work around fibroids in medicine, science, and the law. The White Dress Project, founded by Valbrun 11 years ago, provides education on treatments, hosts events to link women with doctors, and advocates for legislation to fund fibroids research. It has raised more than $200,000 to fund the work and help women attend the events, federal tax records show. It's a time for our community to really rally around each other and support each other, Valbrun said. The White Dress Project has taken Valbrun around the world. In the United States, she worked to establish July as National Fibroids Awareness Month. Internationally, she has advocated for more awareness about fibroids in India, Ghana, South Africa, and England. If we can have more of these real conversations, real storytelling points, then it will inform and influence the research and the data, she said. For Valbrun, the successful removal of her fibroids in 2013, 2018, and 2023 changed her life. A decade after her first myomectomy, Valbrun was pregnant. I was like, oh my gosh, this is it, she said. On our 10th wedding anniversary. What a beautiful story. That joy, however, was fleeting. Just a few months later, she suffered a miscarriage. The heartbreak was intense, but she didn't give up. Months later, on the 10th anniversary of the White Dress Project, she became pregnant again. And this time, everything went smoothly. In February, their perseverance was rewarded. The Valbruns welcomed their son, Josiah Christian Valbrun, into the world. It's very surreal, Tanika Valbrun said. I'm much happier. Even though parenting is the hardest job in the world, like everybody says, just looking at his face every day, it's just all worth it. That was the article titled, Breaking the South's Bias on Uterus Removal, Especially for Black Women. This was written by Chaya Tong and Justin Price and published September 14th, 2025 in the Sunday edition of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution newspaper. That's all the time we have this week. If you would like to replay this program or past editions of the African American Hour, you can find them wherever you get your podcast or in the Audio Reader archives at reader.ku.edu. I'm Byron Buckner, and thank you for listening to the African American Hour.